Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now!
The new Constitution was seen as creating a Europe that would be a playground for the multinational corporations, and that's why workers and the salaried voted overwhelmingly against it.
Dominique de Villepin is named Prime Minister of France following the massive defeat of Jacques Chirac's government, with the French voting no on the European Union Constitution. Then we look at gay marriage legislation in Native America. We'll talk with the president of the Navajo Nation and a Cherokee woman who's fighting for legal recognition in the tribal courts.
In the spring of 2004, me and my partner was faced with an opportunity to get married through Cherokee Nation. On May 13, 2004, we were able to get our license, and still a year later, we are trying to file it.
We'll also look at energy exploitation and the ban on uranium mining in Navajo country. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In France, President Jacques Chirac has named Dominique de Villepin as the country's new prime minister after voters rejected a referendum on the European Union Constitution. De Villepin is the former French ambassador to the United Nations, a close ally of Chirac. He replaces Jean-Pierre Raffarin, who resigned as prime minister earlier today. On Sunday, French voters decisively rejected ratification of the new European Constitution, plunging President Chirac's government into chaos and casting uncertainty on the future of European politics. We'll have more on this in just a few minutes. In Iraq on Monday, U.S. forces arrested and detained the head of the leading Sunni political party in Iraq. The politician, Mohsen Abdelhamid, said U.S. forces burst into his home, tied his hands, put a hood over his head, and then led to an undisclosed location. Three of his sons were also detained during the raid. Following protests from Iraq's president, Jalal Talabani, the U.S. released Hamid, claiming the raid and arrest took place by accident. Meanwhile, four U.S. troops and four Italian soldiers have been killed in separate aircraft crashes over the past day. The cause of neither crash is known. In the Iraqi city of Hilla, 27 people died Sunday after suicide car bombers hit a crowd of police officers. Another 118 people were wounded. On Saturday, three suicide car bombs exploded in Mosul, killing six and wounding nearly 60. Another seven people died Friday in a suicide car bomb attack in Tikrit. In Basra, the city's police chief has admitted to the Guardian of London he's effectively lost control of three-quarters of his officers. This is in part because sectarian militias have infiltrated the force and are using their posts to carry out political assassinations. Basra is Iraq's second largest city. And in Britain, the Independent of London is reporting 11 British soldiers are under investigation for committing war crimes following the killing of an Iraqi civilian. The U.S. mistreatment of detainees at Guantanamo Bay in Iraq remain in the headlines throughout the weekend. Last week, Amnesty International issued a damning report criticizing the Bush administration for ignoring international law. Amnesty's William Schultz charged Washington has, quote, become a leading purveyor and practitioner of torture and ill-treatment, and that senior officials should face prosecution by other governments for violations of the Geneva Conventions and the U.N. Convention Against Torture. Schultz said, quote, if the U.S. government continues to shirk its responsibility, Amnesty International calls on foreign governments to uphold their obligations under international law by investigating all senior U.S. officials involved in the torture scandal. Schultz went on to say, quote, if those investigations support prosecution, the government should arrest any official who enters their territory and begin legal proceedings against them. Over the weekend, General Richard Myers, Vice President Dick Cheney, and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice all dismissed Amnesty's report. Myers, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, claimed Guantanamo Bay was a, quote, model facility, and that Amnesty's report is, quote, absolutely irresponsible. During that same interview, Myers revealed the U.S. has detained 68,000 people since the September 11th attacks. Meanwhile, Vice President Dick Cheney told CNN he's, quote, offended by Amnesty's description of Guantanamo Bay as, quote, the gulag of our times. Cheney said, quote, For Amnesty International to suggest that somehow the U.S. is a violator of human rights, I frankly just don't take them seriously. Cheney also attempted to dismiss the widespread reports of mistreatment of detainees. He said, quote, "Occasionally there are allegations of mistreatment, but if you trace those back in nearly every case, it turns out to come from somebody who's been inside and been released to their home country and now are peddling lies about how they were treated." Condoleezza Rice also weighed in on Amnesty's report describing the group's findings as, quote, absurd. Meanwhile, demonstrators from Global Exchange and Code Pink interrupted a speech by Condoleezza Rice in San Francisco Friday. The protesters stood up during the event and started screaming, quote, "Stop the torture, stop the killing, U.S. out of Iraq." The protesters were wearing black hoods and cloaks in an attempt to recreate the most famous image on the Abu Ghraib prison torture scandal. The protesters were arrested and removed from the building. The New York Times is reporting today the CIA has created a new generation of shell companies to make it easier for the Bush administration to secretly fly suspects around the world. The paper focuses on the North Carolina-based firm Aero Contractors, which was founded by a CIA officer who once served as chief pilot for Air America, a Cold War-era CIA-owned airline. According to flight records, Aero Contractors has repeatedly landed at Guantanamo Bay, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Libya. The CIA appears to own 26 planes, all of which are owned by a web of seven shell corporations that appear to have no employees. The planes are then operated by real companies that are either controlled by or tied to the CIA. In addition to Aero Contractors, the Times identified two Florida companies as likely CIA front companies, Pegasus Technologies and Tepper Aviation. The Sunday Times of London's reporting it has uncovered new evidence that the U.S. and British governments significantly intensified bombing raids over Iraq in the year before the 2003 invasion in an attempt to provoke Saddam Hussein into giving the Allies an excuse to attack. By August 2002, 7 months before the invasion began, the strikes were so frequent that the Times described it as a full-air offensive. At the time, the U.S. and British governments justified the bombings by claiming they were simply enforcing the no-fly zones. A group of 40 retired military personnel, including many retired generals, are campaigning for the Pentagon to reverse last year's demotion of General John Riggs. The three-star general was demoted after he warned that the U.S. military was overstretched in Iraq and Afghanistan. In an interview with the Baltimore Sun, he said the Army would need to be substantially increased in order to meet its global commitments. This made him the first senior active duty officer to publicly urge a larger army. Within months, he was demoted. According to the Pentagon, he was demoted because he allowed outside contractors to perform work they were not supposed to do. But many believe the motivation behind his demotion was politics and the fact that he publicly disagreed with Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. The Baltimore Sun points out a senior officer's loss of a star is a punishment seldom used, and then usually only for the most serious offenses. In recent years, generals and admirals faced with far more serious official findings, including the scandals at the Navy's Tailhook Convention, the Air Force Academy, and Abu Ghraib prison, have continued in their careers or retired with no loss of rank. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting two Army analysts who played a key role in the intelligence failure in Iraq have received job performance awards in each of the past 3 years. The analysts had inaccurately concluded Saddam Hussein was seeking to buy aluminum tubes in order to bolster the country's alleged nuclear weapons program. The tubes turned out to be for ordinary rockets, but the Bush administration used the nuclear claim as a justification for the invasion. No major reprimand or penalty has been announced publicly in connection with the intelligence failures on Iraq. George Tenet resigned as Director of Central Intelligence, but was later awarded the Medal of Freedom by President Bush. In Israel, one of the country's best-known television personalities is making headlines for his criticism of Israel's actions in the occupied territories. The man, Chaim Yavin, is known in Israel as Mr. TV. He was a longtime anchor of the news on Israel's Channel 1. Until this week, most Israelis had never heard him express his opinion on political matters. But that's all changed this week with the broadcast of a new film he personally shot about settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. During the film, Yavin says, quote, "Since 1967, We have been brutal conquerors, occupiers, suppressing another people. The New York Times reports the film has been so controversial that Yavin's own employer, the state-run Channel One, refused to air it. Instead, it's airing on a commercial channel. The United States has officially refused to extradite a Cuban man to Venezuela to face terrorism charges. The man, Luis Posada Carriles, is wanted to stand trial for the 1976 bombing of a commercial airliner that killed 73 people. Posada is a U.S.-trained Cuban exile who's been trying to violently overthrow Castro's government for the past 40 years. He snuck into the United States 2 months ago. He's seeking political asylum. The Cuban and Venezuelan governments have accused the Bush administration of harboring a terrorist. New studies show the number of households in the country with a net worth of $1 million rose by about 20% last year. There are now 7.5 million so-called millionaire households in the country. Meanwhile, the Economic Policy Institute is reporting that real wages for non-management employees are falling at their fastest rate in 14 years. The last time salaries fell this steeply was at the start of 1991.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care.
Sarah Thompson, Is It for Freedom? Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. And it was great to see Sarah Thompson and other musicians at Northland College in Ashland, Wisconsin, this weekend as the Northland College graduation took place and a new low-power FM radio station went on air. Welcome, WRNC, to the community radio family. I'm Amy Goodman. French President Jacques Chirac has named Dominique de Villepin as prime minister following the government defeat in Sunday's vote on the European Union Constitution. Villepin is the former interior and foreign minister and close ally of Chirac. In the run-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, Villepin led France's opposition to the war. He replaces Jean-Pierre Raffarin, who tendered his resignation minutes earlier. On Sunday, French voters decisively rejected ratification of the new European Union Constitution, plunging Chirac's government into chaos and casting uncertainty on the future of Europe's integration drive. The no vote was 55%. The turnout was around 70%. France is a founding member of the European Union. It's the first country to reject the Constitution, which can only take effect if all 25 member states ratify it. Wednesday, the Netherlands holds a non-binding referendum on the Constitution. It's widely expected it will be rejected by voters as well. Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Tony Blair hinted he may postpone the referendum planned for next year in Britain, calling for a, quote, time of reflection on the text. We're joined on the telephone from New York by Doug Ireland, who spends half his time in France, longtime journalist, has lived also in France for a decade, writing on European politics and culture. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Doug.
Good morning.
Well, let's start off by you talking about this massive defeat for the European Union Constitution and for the French government.
The Sunday victory of the no against the European Constitution, Amy, was a political revolt that was a slap in the face to the political elites of France, left, right, and center. The leaders of all of the major political formations in France put their reputations on the line and campaigned very hard for a yes vote of the Constitution. The rejection of the Constitution, however, was not a nationalist rejection. It was an economic rejection, mm-hmm. because the French electorate, by 10 points, mm-hmm. said no to this Constitution because it was perceived mm-hmm. as creating a Europe that would be a playground for the multinational corporations. France is in the middle of an economic crisis, 10% unemployment. Factories are being moved from France to low-wage Eastern European countries, a phenomenon in the French called delocalization. The anguish and fear of loss of jobs grips a great part of the French employee classes. And the exit polls showed very clearly that the victory of the no was driven by economic concerns. Two-thirds of salaried employees voted against the Constitution, mm-hmm. and three-quarters of the working class voted against the Constitution. And that is why this morning's choice of Dominique de Villepin as the new French prime minister is rather astonishing as a response to this economically motivated political revolt.
Why is that?
Because de Villepin has no domestic experience to speak of except for his last 18 months as interior minister. He's an aristocrat who spent most of his life in the Foreign Service. He has never been elected to anything, so he has very little real sense of the daily preoccupations of the French in their daily lives, especially their social and economic preoccupations. He's also someone who's got a political tin ear. It was de Villepin who, when he was the Secretary General of the Élysée Palace, meaning he was Chirac's presidential chief of staff, it was de Villepin who was the architect of the dissolution of the legislature of Parliament in 1997, which to provoke early parliamentary elections. Chirac's conservative coalition lost those elections disastrously, and they led to the victory of the socialist-led coalition and 5 years of socialist Lionel Jospin as prime minister. De Villepin is therefore widely detested by the members of Chirac's own parliamentary party as the man responsible for that electoral disaster. In fact, Le Figaro yesterday quoted one of the leaders of Chirac's party in parliament as saying that not a single member of the presidential majority supported the choice of de Villepin as prime minister. Probably a slight exaggeration, but not by much. So you take a man who's had no experience in domestic policy and none in economic policy, a man who's got a political tin ear, who's not a politician, as your response to an economically motivated political revolt, it shows that Chirac is really not that skilled in the way he's responding to Sunday's vote. In addition, by the way, there's a fascinating fact about de Villepin, which is not known in America. De Villepin is very fond of wiretaps and secret police reports. This was revealed by the newsweekly L'Express back in April, which reported that when de Villepin was foreign minister, and many of the staff of the Quai d'Orsay, where the foreign ministry is headquartered, said that they were convinced that their telephones were tapped on orders from de Villepin when he became interior minister 18 months ago. The first thing he said was, "I want to know everything the journalists are saying." And he would spend hours poring over the daily confidential reports from the Renseignements Généraux, the RG, which is the secret political police in France, which spies not only on the political life of the country, but on the private lives of well-known personalities, politicians, and journalists. He is described as a very brutal man in his operational style. All in all, I think it's a strange choice, but if you know Jacques Chirac, it's understandable, because more than anything else, Chirac hates Nicolas Sarkozy, the man who has been preparing a presidential campaign against Chirac for the last 2 years. Sarkozy got himself elected as the chairman of Chirac's party. He's overwhelmingly popular with the party rank and file. He has been leading in the public opinion polls for the presidential elections in France to be held in 2 years, and beats Chirac regularly as the choice of the right in those polls. There's been bad blood between the two men ever since Sarkozy had been the boyfriend for a while of Chirac's daughter. And this has deepened into a poisonous political relationship between the two men. And Chirac hates Sarkozy. And he saw de Villepin as the only figure that he had in his stable capable, perhaps, of beating Sarkozy as the choice of the right for president in 2007.
It's interesting you should talk about de Villepin loving wiretaps, because I think the way he's most known here in this country is for his fierce opposition to the invasion and standing up to President Bush at the United Nations. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we know about the wiretapping or the spying on of the UN Security Council members at the time of the lead up to various votes and discussions about the invasion.
Well, it's important to remember that Jacques Chirac's opposition to the war in Iraq was not ideological. It was opportunistic. The French people overwhelmingly, right and left, 80% opposed the invasion of Iraq. Chirac is an old opportunist. Sensed very well, had his finger in the wind, understood that the Iraq war was going to be terribly unpopular in his country, and therefore decided to take a position against it. And de Villepin, as his liege man and as foreign minister, became the spokesman for that politics. But it would be really quite wrong of American progressives to see in de Villepin some sort of political hero for carrying out that French policy decided upon by Chirac. It doesn't mean in any moment any deep opposition to imperial politics. Indeed, de Villepin, one of his great specialties is Africa. He was the head of the Foreign Ministry's African Bureau for a number of years. And, of course, in those years, as it has been a long French tradition under both governments of left and right, France has exercised enormous power and sway over its now independent former colonies in Africa. So this is not an anti-imperialist who has been named as Prime Minister of France. He's a very traditional defender of French national interests and indeed prerogatives in its former colonial empire.
And tomorrow the Dutch are expected to vote down the European Constitution.
Oh, indeed. There's very little doubt about it. The last poll has yesterday had 60% no in the Netherlands, and that's just the final nail in the coffin of this absolutely dreadful, highly conservative European constitution. You know, there's a myth going around that this constitution would have made Europe stronger. I don't read it that way at all. For me, this was a constitution for a weaker Europe, particularly vis-a-vis Washington. In the new European constitution, which has now been rejected by France, it is written in concrete into that constitution that European Union security policy is subordinated to NATO. Moreover, for the European Union to take a position like the position that France and Germany took against the Iraq War, you would have to have unanimity. It means that just as the United States bought off a block of largely Eastern European countries during the Iraq War to support the invasion, Washington did again block the European Union from taking a position, even with a strengthened president that the new constitution provided for and a strengthened foreign minister. It could block the Union from taking any position in opposition to American adventurers abroad rather easily. Moreover, this constitution could never have been amended except by unanimity, which means that all the multinational corporations would have to do is buy off some corrupt little country like Albania to block any change in the Constitution's infamous Chapter 3, which institutionalizes the most savage kind of free market economics, creates a host of policy decisions leading to privatization, and undermines the social safety net in the advanced European Western countries.
Doug Ireland, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Longtime journalist, has lived in France for a decade, writing on European politics and culture. Your website for people to follow your blog on this issue?
Yes. If they just go to Google and type in the word Direland, D-I-R-E-L-A-N-D, my blog will come right up, and they'll be able to read this morning about the wiretapper.
Doug Ireland, thanks for joining us, a columnist for years for The Nation, The Village Voice, The New York Observer, and the Paris Daily Libération, also a contributing editor of PAS, the monthly HIV-positive community magazine. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Angelique Kidjo-Ogolo here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. As we broadcast on over 330 radio and television stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and affiliates, on NPR stations and low-power FM stations, public access TV and PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we video and audio stream at democracynow.org or closed caption for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. And our headlines are now in Spanish on our website at democracynow.org. Well, the debate over gay marriage continues to divide the nation. In the last year, many states have passed laws prohibiting the recognition of same-sex marriage. However, at the same time, some states have moved forward in granting legal rights to gay and lesbian couples. Connecticut recently joined Vermont in legalizing civil unions, which are designed to afford the same legal protections, rights, and responsibilities as marriage. Oregon could soon become the third state to legalize civil unions. The gay marriage debate has been playing out in Indian country as well, touching on issues of tribal sovereignty, cultural tradition, and legal rights. The Navajo Indian tribe is the largest tribe in the United States. It extends into Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah, covering over 27,000 square miles. In April, the Navajo Tribal Council passed the Dine Marriage Act of 2005, which banned same-sex marriage. Earlier this month, however, the president of the Navajo Nation, Joe Shirley, vetoed the legislation, calling it discriminatory. The tribal council is planning to try to overturn Shirley's ban. Meanwhile, in Cherokee Nation, the second largest tribe in the U.S., encompassing 14 counties in northeast Oklahoma, the tribal council also banned same-sex marriage. But the ban was passed after a lesbian couple had already obtained a tribal marriage application. Don McKinley and Kathy Reynolds are now fighting for legal recognition of the marriage in the Cherokee tribal courts. We'll speak with Don in a moment, but first we go to the president of the Navajo Nation, Joe Shirley, speaking to us from Arizona. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you talk about what is happening among the Navajo around the issue of same-sex marriage, the legislation that was passed by your tribal council, and why you decided to veto it?
Well, I really don't know why the Navajo Nation Council even considered banning same-sex marriage. Because on Navajo land, it's not even an issue, and that's one of the reasons that I vetoed the legislation, because it's not an issue. We're not talking about it. The elderly, the medicine people, are not talking about it. Nobody is coming forward to say that gay people. They're not coming forward to say we want to get married in the tribal courts. It's not an issue, and I don't know why the nation's council is concerned about it, and in that they've passed a legislation to say that we shall not have it. There are other issues that they really ought to be concerned about, you know. You know, that driving under the influence is really killing a lot of people, even the young, bootlegging, domestic violence, gangs. These are just some of the issues that we really need to be working on and doing something about, not banning same-sex marriage. And then, too, I believe that the right to be, whatever that is a real basic right. And in this case, 67 people said that, we shall not have the same sex marriage. That's, out of a nation that's a little bit over 300,000, what's 67 people doing trying to be discriminatory, trying to take away a real basic human right. I don't think that's right.
And yet, President Shirley, the Navajo Tribal Council passed the bill with a vote of 67-0. passed the bill banning same-sex marriage.
Yes, that's what I mean. What 6 to 7 people do in trying to be discriminatory, trying to take away a basic human right, the right to be. I don't think that should be the case. And thereby, I vetoed the legislation. If anything, you know, like I said, there's a little bit over 300,000 of us. I think we're approaching about 100,000 registered voters. If anything, at the very least, if you're going to talk about curbing basic rights or taking a position on a basic right, give it to the people. Let the people decide how they're going to address same-sex marriages.
Will it be given as a referendum to the Navajo people?
I'm not sure. Of course, right now, I believe the Navajo Nation Council is going to be going into a special session this coming Friday on June 3 to try and overturn my veto. And in my veto message, it says, you know, at the very least, give it to the people in referendum. I don't think they're going to discuss it at that time. I don't know if they cannot override the veto. I don't know if they're going to try and give it to the people in referendum form.
We're talking to the president of the Navajo Nation. We're talking to Joe Shirley in Arizona about his veto of a unanimous vote for same-sex marriage in the Navajo Tribal Council. Now, the Diné Marriage Act, Diné referring to the Navajo Nation, goes a step further than banning gay marriage. It also states the tribe will not recognize such a marriage if performed in other states, for example, in Massachusetts.
Yes, I believe so. But then again, like I said, you know, it's the same thing. It's just stating the position against the same-sex marriage in a little different way.
Well, we're also joined on the telephone by one member of a Cherokee couple named Dawn McKinley. Her legal advocate, David Cornsilk, is also on the phone with us. Can you talk about your union with your partner and what has happened in Cherokee Nation? Also, a tribal council vote has taken place. Welcome, Dawn.
Well, we were able to get the license. They didn't have a problem at all issuing us the license. And I would like to set straight that we did not go get the license to be activists or to upset anybody. We took an opportunity that was presented to us, and it was something that we believe that we have the right to do. And we just wanted our marriage to be recognized more than anything in our nation, and just we're not hurting anybody by our marriage. We live our lives. A lot of these people that are throwing the fit and upset with this census came out last year, May 13th, when we were issued the license. They don't know us. We don't interact with them. They have nothing to do with us, so we're not hurting them. And I felt we have got a outpour of support, but not from our nation as I thought we would. And, you know, it was their laws that we were able to get married by, and now they want to change them, or they already have changed them. But when they did change them, they did not give us the opportunity to stand up and speak and hear our voice. They decided for us out of, you can ask David, David was at 12 that voted for it, and they didn't ask us. And like the chief of Navajo said, they didn't take it to the people. You know, who are those people to decide for us?
David Cornsilk, how many people are on the tribal council? How many voted for and against? In Navajo land, it was unanimous.
There are 15 council members serving on the Cherokee Nation Council, representing approximately 250,000 enrolled Cherokee citizens, and it was unanimous.
How significant now is what has taken place? this union. Dawn, when were you married? When did you have your commitment ceremony?
We had our ceremony on May 18th. And
how long had you been together?
We have been together 5 years.
And the response of your community for the years that you've been together?
The response on our community?
Yeah,
our,
from your community. Have you felt support? Have you felt alienation?
No, you know, we haven't really had any either way. I mean, we lived together as a married couple the last 5 years. Nobody has paid any attention to us until we got this license. Nobody, you know, they could care less what we were doing as long as we didn't go to try to get married. And now that we have this license, they're all up busy in our stuff and want to know what's going on. And they all have an opinion now.
I understand a national organization, David Cornsilk, is going to take on this case. Can you talk about that?
We received a call from an attorney for the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and they were very excited to have the opportunity to represent Kathy and Dawn in the tribal court and have offered whatever level of services they have at their disposal, all the way from simply writing motions and briefs to having full-out representation by one of their staff attorneys. And we have opted for having full representation. Up to the present time, Kathy and Dawn have been in tribal district court unrepresented. And so that case has been handled by them writing their own briefs and motions, and the district court ruled against them, I believe, in direct contradiction to tribal law. And they wrote an appeal to the tribal Supreme Court called the Judicial Appeals Tribunal, and that court has agreed with us that the lower court lacks jurisdiction in this case. But the case can be probably will be very complicated, and we're very excited to have a national organization with its resources and legal expertise step up to assist in preserving this marriage certificate.
Final comment on McKinley as we move to another segment in Native America. Your thoughts now and taking this to the tribal courts.
Well, you know, you always hope for the best outcome. You always hope that we can file it and we can go on with our lives. And, you know, how many people have to sit a year later still hoping to file their marriage license? Not very many. But no matter what happens and what comes out of this, the one thing they can't take away from us, and that's our love for each other and our life. I mean, we're still going to be together, and we're still going to live our lives together. And they can't take that away from us, no matter what they do, no matter what they decide on this. And like I said, we just hope that it comes out for the best. But if it doesn't, we still have each other, and that's what matters.
Well, Dawn McKinley and David Cornsilk, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We're going to stay on the line with Navajo President Joe Shirley to talk about the ban on uranium mining. And in a related story on the issue of gay marriage, New York's highest court ruled just this past Friday that the mayor of the village of New Paltz will face local prosecution for violating domestic relations law. Last year, the mayor, Jason West, oversaw the marriage of 19 same-sex couples. If convicted, he faces a year in jail. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Uh-huh.
Winter Tribal by Little Otter Singers. They are Ojibwe. And a shout out to our Ojibwe friends at WOJB in northern Wisconsin. Again, we were just by your community this weekend. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Navajo President Joe Shirley approved legislation last month banning uranium mining and processing on Navajo land. There's currently no mining on the Navajo reservation, but Hydro Resources Inc. has been working with the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission for years to try to get approval for mining near the Navajo communities of Crown Point and Church Rock, New Mexico. The company estimates nearly 100 million pounds of uranium exists on those sites. Companies mined land in Navajo country for 40 years. The impact is still felt. Navajo have suffered from high cancer rates and respiratory problems. Their land has been dotted with contaminated tailings and abandoned mines. We continue our conversation with Navajo President Joe Shirley. Also on the line with us is Earl Tully, Vice President of Diné Care. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with the Navajo President, Joe Shirley. Can you talk about the uranium mining ban?
Yes, ever since I started campaigning for the presidency of the Navajo Nation, I took a position to say that if I were to be elected president, I'm not going to allow, I'm going to give it everything I have to stand against the further mining of uranium. And then, of course, I was elected president a little bit over 2 years ago. And true to what I had said, we worked on introducing legislation, getting legislation on the books to ban the further mining of uranium. And I'm really appreciative, about the Nation's Council, for acquiescing in the position to ban the further mining of uranium. There are no answers to the cancer, to the plagues that is caused by exposure to uranium. And if you don't have the answers to the cancer that it causes, why have it? That's basically my position and my belief, and I take that from medicine people. It's just if there are no answers for it. And it has killed many of my medicine people. And because of that, there are some of the ceremonies that they used to know that we don't know anymore. It has killed a lot of elderly. It has killed a lot of young. Today, there are many people living in the areas where uranium was mined, sick with cancer. Some of them are bedridden. And then, like I said, there are just no answers for it. If there are no answers for the cancer that the uranium causes, why have it? Like I said, I'm glad that our nation's council stood with me to ban the further mining of uranium.
Earl Tully, how did you get involved in this issue as Vice President of Diné Care?
In response to that, I would imagine that my particular advocacy started years ago during the RECA, Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. In the community where I reside, there were a number of exploratory mines across the Navajo Nation. Roughly about 3,000 mines were there. But let me say this, though. For decades, the coal miners used canaries in the coal mines to alert them of dangerous gases. The dead canary signaled a clear warning that gases were high, and therefore it would soon kill people. To the contrary, the industries and the powers that be that open up these uranium minings utilize our people as canaries. And today, those particular individuals are still being impacted. Our particular families are highly devastated because of the exposure to uranium. And I guess one of the things that I would like to share here is that in people are living in communities where there is high unemployment, the table of penalties assessed to various communities are very, very different. I remember in my advocacy during the RECA, the reauthorization of the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, we understood that the people of color communities they were not receiving the same compensation and the same care from EPA or other regulatory officials as in regards to white communities. And I think that this is evidently true here in the four corners of the United States. I think the number of the people that are living out here basically have to go out and take care of their own. Take care of their own meaning that when you do not have facilities enough to accommodate the number of sicknesses that are here. And one of the atrocities here in the Navajo Nation is that we do not have adequate facilities to take care of those that have been exposed to uranium. And it's important for us to really realize that that the cancer rate here on the Navajo Nation is very, very high. You know, the cancer rates among Native American communities with uranium mining are 17 times higher than the general population. And we could toss these numbers out there, you know, again and again and again, but they're all published in the context that this particular extraction of natural resources is something that we should not be doing.
Let me ask Joe Shirley, president of the Diné Nation, if there has been compensation for the high levels of sickness and what companies specifically are involved.
I didn't catch the last part of it.
What companies are specifically involved? First, has there been compensation?
The only compensation that I know about is coming from the U.S. government. Of course, like I said, I've been here a couple of years, and I'm still being enlightened as to what is out there relative to any particular issue that faces the Navajo Nation. In this case, the only compensation that I know that it comes down to some of the people who were exposed to uranium is from the U.S. government, and that is very inadequate. And, of course, right now, working with organizations like the NACARE and some of the other ones, you know, we're trying to up the amount of monies that are given as compensation to some of the families. You have to go through a very rigorous process to even get a compensation. Even there, we're trying to lighten up on the legislation, recommending some changes, you know, to the laws that actually is used to give compensation to some of the people affected by uranium exposure to uranium. I don't, like I said, believe that it is adequate. It's too slow, and we need to change the laws to make it a little bit easier.
How does this, let me put this question to Earl Tully, how does this issue of uranium mining and the ban fit into the politics of overall energy politics in the Navajo Nation?
I think one of the major problems in this, if I could, I'd like to go back and answer a question previously asked. As far as the RECA is concerned, you know, before the amendment was made, $100,000 was considered the adequate, compensation for a particular person who had filed. And $100,000, you take the average cost of 30% for a lawyer, so the family would only get $70,000. And when you spread that around, it's not going to go too far. And I think one of the areas of RECA is to boost that up to $150,000. So I guess one of the main things that I would like to say is that uranium as a natural raw material being extracted from the heart of the Navajo Nation, soon to follow thereafter are going to be more extractions in regards to the Bush policy and the energy policy that is being currently introduced on the Hill. You know, our brothers and sisters up into the Arctic, where they're harvesting and they're able to gather herbs and wildlife for their particular existence, is going to be impacted by the drilling of gas and then the exploration wells as well. But I would imagine that, you know, soon to follow is that the Indian nations, again, are going to be asked to get, you know, just as they did in World War II, to make a sacrifice for this country again. The sacrifice at that time was, they beckoned the Navajo Nation and other Indian communities to be code talkers during the World War II. And I think that at this time, What's going to happen is that they're going to ask us of our resources again. So I would assume that the continuing quest of energy companies to come onto Navajo, either it be with more exploratory mines, you know, as President Shirley had indicated, that this is not a dead issue. HRI is still, you know, going full force, advocating on those that are Alati holders.
HRI being Hydro Resources Inc.
Yes, and then also, again, there is the idea of Desert Rock, of you know, bringing power plant onto the nation again. Now, our particular community, you know, there's a vast number of our people that do not have adequate water, fresh water supply. They have to bring their containers in 55-gallon drums. This is the year 2005, and we are still hauling water. We still use outhouses, and the mentality of companies coming out here, it's basically not in my backyard, but in your backyard, that is perfectly fine. So I would assume that the push for natural resources and then also power plant developments, that's going to be their carrot at the end of the stick so that we could be gainfully employed here on the nation.
Joe Shirley, what is being done about energy companies' attempt to extract oil, whether it's coal or other companies?
In the case of the uranium, we don't want any more companies coming in. So that's where this ban has been put on the books, and we're going to stand our grounds as a sovereign nation to try to the best of our ability to not let it happen. But as far as coal and natural gas, we're continuing to mine those. Albeit, you know, there are some things that are not good about it, but at least there we're still having to deal with some of these energy companies, you know, like coal companies, to continue to mine our coal so that we can continue to have jobs and revenues. But we're wanting to have them go into this clean coal technology. Where, you know, when they do mine the coal, you know, it is they don't pollute the air. To the best of our abilities, we're trying to, you know, stand our grounds on that, you know, with some of these coal companies.
Earl Tully, we just have 15 seconds. Last comment.
Okay, one of the things here is that I think in many cases race is not the issue, but income. It is. You know, again, I will go back to the average EPA penalties and cleanup by. By race is very, very different. The people of colors are highly impacted in a sense that they do not receive adequate just compensation as in white communities.
5 seconds.
One of the things that I'd like to say is the Empire of Japan was amply compensated, and the Navajo Nation is still waiting for compensation.
On that note, Earl Tully, Vice President of Diné Care, and Joe Shirley, President of Navajo Nation. I want to thank you very much both for joining us, and a shout-out to our friends at KGLP and KUNM in New Mexico and Colorado. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Photo Produced John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, and Nell Geiser. I'm Amy Goodman. Happy birthday to Mike DeFilippo. Thanks for joining us.